Hello and welcome to Risky Talk, the podcast where we talk about risk and evidence and how to talk about risk and evidence. I'm your host, David Spiegelhalter, and in this episode we're talking about the kind of numbers that frequently make headlines and drive the political agenda, statistics about migration, crime and political polls.
We say that statistics aren't just numbers, they're numbers with a social life. They kind of go out into the world.
Actually being upfront in our communications of this statistical uncertainty doesn't undermine people's understanding.
Any number is soft. They've all got weaknesses. The main question is, how do the weaknesses impact the story? What's the question you're asking?
Whether you're in Europe or the US, politics is full of statistical crossfire. Numbers fly back and forth in dodgy campaign promises and national debates on hot topics like migration or crime. But people may think of numbers as cold, hard facts, but they can be surprisingly soft. And it upsets me deeply when I see these numbers being abused. The point is that these kind of statistics are really estimates of what's happening in a country. Is crime going up or down? How many people are coming or leaving a country and where are they coming from? How popular are certain policies or politicians? And is unemployment really falling? Now, actually, just today, it was announced in the UK that unemployment had fallen by 13,000 from the last quarter. So, you know, how accurate is this number? Now, I had some difficulty in actually finding this out. I went onto the website for the Office for National Statistics. I clicked on a button saying strengths and limitations. I found a table you could download. I downloaded a spreadsheet. And in the middle of that, I found out that the margin of error around this 13,000 was plus or minus 73,000. So this seems rather large. So we're going to look at how all these numbers get calculated, who uses them, and how uncertain we should be about them. And in an era when people are increasingly suspicious of statistics, how can we communicate them in a trustworthy way? Now, my guests today all have a professional stake in producing or communicating these numbers. Dr. Robert Cuff is head of statistics at the BBC. Dr. Sarah Dryhurst is a psychologist and researcher at the University of Cambridge. And Ed Humphreyson is Director General for Regulation at the UK Statistics Authority. Now, you all work in different ways with the kinds of numbers I've been mentioning. Can you explain your relationship to these sorts of numbers in your day-to-day working lives? So let's start with you, Robert.
So my job at the BBC is to help journalists when we get a new set of numbers coming in, for example, like the employment figures, or from a Freedom of Information request, or from any dodgy press release that you might get, to help people to understand what are the caveats, where are these numbers soft, how high do we need to put them in the story, and if we need to put them really near the top, can we run it at all?
You know, how many numbers do you have to deal with?
That's a very meta question. So I'm not going to put an exact figure on it, surprisingly, but what I will say is that during the last election, over the last 6 weeks, it has been like drinking from a fire hose. The number of claims and counterclaims that get thrown around are frenetic. And of course, it's not something that I'm dealing with on my own. There are plenty of very qualified and very smart people in the BBC who are very number happy and able to do this stuff. My job is to help them to sort the wheat from the chaff.
So it's a very important part of the news process.
Oh, absolutely. And it's recognised. I'm very lucky to be working in a place where I'm invited into the main editorial conferences, and people really do take the word of the statistician.
Excellent, excellent. Now, Sarah, as a psychologist, you know, what's your insight into the numbers?
So I'm really interested in how people understand risk and uncertainty. And in so doing, we can then design communications about these important numbers, like unemployment data or health statistics or crime statistics, that allow people to be empowered and therefore informed about making decisions about the information, the numbers placed before them.
So what kind of people, what kind of audiences are we talking about?
Well, that's a really excellent question. And I think that that's one of the crucial first steps before we go about designing these communications, is to understand who our audience are, and what they, how they use the numbers, how they use the information, and what they understand. So that might be a public audience, but it might also be a journalist or maybe someone working in a think tank or an MP or a civil servant, for example. So the range of different people who constitute that audience and how they interpret that information may in fact be quite different, and it's important to know exactly who they are.
Ed, you're in charge, you're the policeman for statistics in this country. How do you deal with all these numbers?
Last time I did an interview like this, David, the very first question I was asked was, when I go to parties of permanent secretaries and senior civil servants and MPs, do they all shun me? And like nobody, everybody refuses to talk to me because of all of the things that we've done, which they've disliked so much. So yes, my job is to set the standards kind of upstream of what we've heard of from Robert and Sarah in the way in which government publishes statistics, disseminates those statistics and uses those statistics in policy statements and so on, to make sure that that is done in a trustworthy way, in a way that respects the quality of the data and it has value, it answers the questions that people want it to answer. And I just want to go back to something you said in your introduction. You said that people think of numbers as being cold, hard facts, but in fact they're surprisingly soft. Our version of that phrase is we say that statistics aren't just numbers, they're numbers with a social life. They kind of go out into the world. They're used in ways that impact on the kind of people that Sarah is interested in interacting with, their understanding, and go into Robert's world, how you communicate through broadcast. And it's our job to make sure that they interface with that world in a way that's kind of appropriate and helpful to the public. And sometimes that does involve, yes, indeed, telling government departments and ministers that what they're doing is not kind of consistent with those values and principles.
Oh, that's great. And statistics having a social life, I love it.
Yeah. Well, it's almost exactly the opposite, because the story you were telling, Ed, of going to parties and being shunned, is kind of the opposite of every statistician's social life, is which they go to parties and end up in the kitchen, not necessarily talking to anybody else.
Robert, the bitter truth is I don't get invited to any of those parties in the first place.
Okay, let's talk about migration numbers. And of course, it's a really hot topic here in the UK. Immigration was a key issue in the Brexit referendum. In the US, we've got Trump's war with Mexico. It's all about immigration. But whatever your politics, we want the numbers fueling these debates to be as accurate as possible and to be communicated as effectively as possible. So let's start with a really simple question. So in the UK, how do we know how many migrants there are? Ed?
Well, this is sounds like a very simple question. It's got quite a complicated answer, because the way it's done is that the Office for National Statistics takes a survey of people entering the country and a survey of people leaving the country at ports and airports, and asks them about their intentions. It asks them a sample of the people coming through through the airports, whether they intend to stay, how long they intend to stay for, the purpose of their visit to the UK, whether it's for work or for travel for leisure or for study. And then similarly, at the exit point, asking people how long they stayed for. And out of that survey, which has about 5,000 respondents in a given year, so it's a very, very small sample of the many millions of people that are flowing in and out of the country at any one point. And I can see what the listeners won't see, the look of shock and horror on your face, David, as I say that.
I also know that when I've seen them, I make sure I avoid them because I don't want to be held up.
I'm always disappointed that they've not asked me. I've always wanted to be asked, but they never have. So the estimate comes from that survey, and then it's blended. That survey information is blended with some what's called administrative data, for example, some visa information from people applying for visas, and out of that, ONS produce an estimate of the numbers of immigrants, the numbers of emigrants, and therefore the net migration, the difference between the two.
And you put some uncertainty around that?
There's very considerable uncertainty. I don't have the latest figures at my fingertips, but we'll be talking about on net migration of 250,000, a margin of error of into the tens of thousands either side of that.
Do you believe those margins of error?
I do believe those margins of error, and I think they should be taken very, very seriously. And we have been concerned as the regulator of statistics for some time about the use to which this survey is being put to create this net migration figure. And I guess what it all comes down to is lots of weight is being put on that migration estimate. You know, it's being used as a way of helping people understand the kind of dynamics of the UK's population. It's been a very important estimate for how people understand what's going on in the country, and it's bearing a lot of weight, probably more weight than it can really truly bear, given the fact that it's a sample of a very small fraction of the people coming in and out of the country. And even then, it's an intentions-based survey. It's asking people what they intend to do or what they have done. It's not kind of getting it into verification of what they've actually done. So it has a lot of flaws beyond the mere sampling issue.
Exactly. So, but hasn't the status of these figures changed recently?
For exactly these reasons, what we do when we go out and look at what government is publishing for statistics is we assess what we call the trustworthiness, quality, and value. And if they fulfill the highest standards of those principles, we award a kite mark, a designation. It's called the National Statistics Designation. And it means that the producer is doing everything they can to create high quality statistics. We confer it. We can also remove it. And that's exactly what we've done for these migration statistics. We removed the National Statistics Designation. I should say, very much in collaboration with the Office for National Statistics, who produced them, because between us, we looked at the latest rounds of evidence coming from the survey, and we felt, as they did, that there was so much uncertainty that it no longer merited the designation, and that a different approach was probably going to be required to produce a more robust estimate.
And that's what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah, so it's now called an experimental statistic. Yeah. Which means it's a statistic in development, and that's giving a very strong signal to users that they need to be very aware of what goes into the mix rather than just taking the number at face value.
Sarah, you've looked at the whole problem of trying to communicate the uncertainty around these migration statistics. What's your approach been?
Well, I think it's been twofold. So going back to what we were talking about before, getting to know the audience, the first thing that I did in trying to work out the best way to communicate these numbers was to actually speak to the people who are using them. And when it comes to the ONS migration figures, although they are public-facing statistics, many of the users are perhaps what we call expert users. They might be journalists, they might be civil servants, people in think tanks, who perhaps know a little bit more about the migration figures and the underlying statistics than a member of the general public might. So I spoke to some of those users. And as I spoke to people, there were a few themes that emerged from those interviews. So I think the first theme was one of the trustworthiness of those numbers. What these users were concerned about if the ONS were to present the statistical uncertainty around these migration trends was that the users of the data, be it expert users or members of the public, might actually lose faith in those numbers. So it might actually undermine their trust in the numbers, and it might cause them even to shift away from those national statistical sources to potentially even less reliable sources of those numbers. So that's one thing that came out. Another concern that people had was that the users might not actually even understand what that uncertainty information actually is. So the way in which it can be communicated is you might have a trend on a graph showing the net migration, and then you'll have a confidence interval around that showing the upper and lower bound around that particular trend. And what some of the expert users said was, well, other people, while we understand this ourselves, other people might not actually know what it means. And so maybe we shouldn't be communicating that uncertainty because people might misinterpret it. And then I think the final theme that came out was to do with the quality of the underlying evidence of those statistics. So what some of these users were saying was, well, for people who are viewing these numbers who do have a bit more of a handle on the statistics, if you present the statistical uncertainty associated with that trend, and as Ed was saying, that's based on a sample, a fairly small sample, that uncertainty is the direct uncertainty associated with that particular trend and that particular sample. But there are questions about how representative that sample is of the broader population. And if there are issues with the quality of the underlying data, then representing just statistical, direct statistical uncertainty around that trend might actually be misleading if you're not upfront about the broader quality issues as well.
And you talk to all sorts of audiences?
Yes, absolutely. So as I said, there were people dealing with these statistics in the civil service and in the media, but I also talked to a variety of different campaign groups as well, both on the left and on the right, who had different political agendas that they were interested in using these numbers to inform.
You also, I think, tested out some particular ways to visualize the uncertainty around these series. You know, how did these go down?
Absolutely. So I think that was the other component of the study that was really important. After I'd spoken to people, users of these statistics, as I said, they voiced these concerns, one of which was that, if we present statistical uncertainty, it might reduce people's trust in the information. And also, if we present it, people might not understand what it means. And so what I wanted to do then was to actually go and test whether that's the case and whether we can be upfront, in fact, and muscular in presenting this uncertainty. So what I did after gathering that information from the audience was we designed a series of presentations of that uncertainty. So we had what we'd call in psychology a control group, which was just a simple graph showing the trend in net migration to the UK over time, which was just a simple line graph, if you like. And we showed that to one group of people. And then we had a variety of other formats of that same graph, but actually presenting the statistical uncertainty around that. So we had one format, which was a sort of an error bar around that, so a 95% confidence interval showing the upper and lower bounds around the central trend. And then we had what we call a fan chart, which was a 30, 60, and 95% confidence interval around the trend. A fuzzy fan chart version, which was a kind of slight blurring of the bands on the fan chart. And then we had what we called a fuzzy chart, which was the full probability distribution around that central trend.
Which looks like a sort of, you know, caterpillars. So.
Exactly. Like
That's the one that gives you a headache.
Yeah, that's the one. It actually makes you feel physically ill.
Yeah. Did that go down very well?
Well, so interestingly, in some of the qualitative comments, people in the interview comments, people did actually say it made their eyes feel a bit funny. But actually, when we tested these formats out, we showed that, interestingly, when you asked people how easy they thought the graphs were to understand, when they saw the uncertainty, those people who saw the uncertainty rated the graphs as being less easy to understand than those people who didn't see the uncertainty, so who just saw that central trend line. But when we actually got people to use the information, when we got more of an objective sense of their understanding of that information, then we found that there was no difference in people's understanding between that group that had seen just the central trend line and the group that had seen these various different uncertainty formats. So it seems that actually being upfront in our communications of the statistical uncertainty, at least, doesn't undermine people's understanding of the information.
But what about their trust of the data?
That's a very good point. And that was also an interesting and pleasing result, in the sense that uncertainty also didn't undermine people's perceptions of the trustworthiness of the data. So it really did indicate that perhaps we can be more muscular in our presentations of these things without worrying that the public won't understand or won't trust the information.
Oh, I think this is fascinating stuff. Ed?
I think the work that you've done, Zara, is just fantastic, and it's just so, so interesting. One thing I'd particularly like to pick out from it, which I find really reassuring in a sense, is that when you've done this work, you found that people are well able to distinguish the trustworthiness of the person, of the organization, from the reliability of the data. And sometimes we hear from statistics producers, we always say, well, you've got to be clear about the uncertainty, and they say, oh, well, that'll make people, you know, have less confidence in us. And I think what your evidence shows is that people, the public, are more sophisticated than that, and they are capable of distinguishing these two concepts: the trustworthiness in terms of the professional objectivity and the public interest of the organization from the characteristics of the data. I think we should really hang on to that. Really, really important finding. It's great stuff.
It's great. So, Robert, what about, you know, taking this into the media and ideas like that? I mean, you're obviously, you know, leading on trying to put more uncertainty into the figures that you're communicating.
Well, I think one of the difficult parts is that for us, people don't have to read what we write. So if you make something less accessible but more informative for an expert audience who need access to that information, well, they're going to love more information and they'll value that and they'll take time to parse it. But if somebody is a choice between reading what you've written and reading about Kim Kardashian, and you're making your stuff harder, Kim Kardashian, straight away. Right? So you have to be very careful about where you deploy these tools when it's important to the story. So if you take the example of migration, really, for a long time the story has been, is migration close to the government's target of 100,000? Now, the margin of error, as I had said, on 250,000 plus or minus tens of thousands, nowhere near it. So why would you include it if that's the question you're asking? So I think the second question after you say, who's my audience, is what's the question? And the way you present uncertainty is very important depending on the question, and particularly for migration, because my understanding of the research as well is people can do quite well on some of the questions you ask them. But Sarah, you deliberately avoided saying, when we ask people, had migration gone up or down? Because they struggle with that question. When you're presenting data on net migration, people do that, like, what does this graph mean in terms of a slightly different question? And so the first order question is, am I giving people the right words to understand this story or this question? And after that, we get into this, you know, is the evidence strong enough? You know, can we lead with the line that we want to lead on?
I think that's a very important point. And actually, in the studies that we did, I did actually try to ask questions to get at whether people understood the concept of net migration, because it isn't that intuitive. And actually, unfortunately, people's comprehension of net migration as a concept was actually fairly low.
Almost as head-wrecking as a fuzzy graph. Yeah, but it is hard, and we have to get it.
I'm confusing myself. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, let's move from migration to another topic that people have got some small interest in. Is crime going up or down? Come on, Ed. You know, what about crime figures? Can we believe them?
I think you can certainly believe some of them. Let me explain. There are essentially two ways of getting a sense of how much crime is taking place in a country. Firstly, you can go and ask the police how much crime they're recording. And secondly, you can go and ask the general population the extent to which they've been victims of crime. And we would say that in general, to get a kind of sense of the level of crime in society, you're much better off asking the victims than asking the police.
Okay. I mean, to many people, that might seem quite surprising, because you're saying that actually just a survey of a reasonably small group of the population is better than an actual whole record of everything that's been recorded by the police in the country. So why is the survey better than all that massive amount of information the police are collecting?
So this is a kind of a specific example of a kind of generic, almost like a fallacy in thinking about statistics, which is that administrative records are kind of 100% complete record, and therefore you can go to them with none of the skepticism that you bring to a survey, because a survey is just a sample. We think that's a very, very dangerous way to think. And just to illustrate that, in the context of the police, what that is recording is what at any given time a particular police force has chosen to record as a crime. And there are lots of things which go into that judgment. There is, of course, their own judgment in terms of how to interpret whether a crime has taken place. But it's also where they focus their effort. They might have a priority in one area in one period, another area in another period, whereas the survey of the population is not so subject to those, what I might call, vicissitudes, actually.
So what's the overall judgment about those two different sources?
Well, in 2014, when I actually started in this role, we took a look at the police recorded crime statistics, and we removed the national statistics designation from that, because we felt that there was just too much exposure to these kind of management issues within the police, what the police thought were important at a time. And we basically said the survey is the more reliable measure. Now, since then, We've looked into this in repeatedly, as you'd imagine, and I think that we recognise and we encourage the Office for National Statistics to do this, to say there will be categories of crime where the police records are particularly good and reliable, and essentially for the very high harm crimes. People are worried about knife crime, a good place to go would be to look at the police records of knife crime. Homicide obviously doesn't really work as a victim survey very well for obvious reasons. So there are places where the police records are better, and actually that's what we now encourage people to do, is to almost kind of pick the best source for the best question. But at the aggregate level, it's the survey which is much better,
because rape, I wouldn't believe the police records on those.
That's a very good example of this phenomenon. Yeah,
so that's another one that's been designated. You're not going to have much left, are you?
There's plenty. There's 850 national statistics.
Oh, I see. Right. There are lots to go.
Great.
So, Robert, when it comes to communicating and crime stats on, you know, from the BBC, how do you tell people that police recorded crime is not considered a reliable number?
Well, I think you have to be careful. I think there are horses for courses, as Ed said, and you want to look at the best statistic to answer the question that people are interested in. I think it's worth saying as well, it's another situation where we've got definitional issues. I mean, saying crime has gone up or gone down, it's kind of a meaningless statement. I mean, I'm not too bothered if there are more computer viruses, or, you know, fewer computer viruses if there are more stabbings. So you've got to, you know, break the story down into the constituent components and then look at the best source of that and try and give people that single summary. I think that's always the best, you know, the kind of the very apex for me of how you deal with uncertainty is not just to say, here's the uncertainty, off you go. There are multiple sources, work it out for yourself. But it's to give people that single summary of taking all the best evidence we can. Here's the strongest thing we can say that's consistent with the evidence. And I think there are great examples in the crime survey of doing that, or the crime releases that come from the ONS, where they triangulate the police recorded knife data with data that come in from accident and emergency on you know, injury with a sharp instrument. So trying to tie together a picture, or on the migration, trying to tie together the passenger survey with national insurance numbers and visas. When you bring all that stuff together, that's when you're really adding value.
Just to go back on this police recording of crime point, I completely agree with Robert that it is a little bit of a horses for courses thing. But lest we forget, in 2014, after we removed the designation, the Inspectorate of Constabulary went around to the 43 police forces in England and Wales and did a comprehensive audit, or a series of comprehensive audits, of how those forces were recording crime, and concluded that the accuracy of crime recorded ranged from some forces who were recording 95-96% of crimes accurately to some which were only recording 60% of crimes accurately. And I think there was one which is even in the 50%. So, you know, you're talking about a very, very wide range of practice. Now, what's happened since then is that the police have really, I think, got their act together on this, and there's been a lot more rigor. But that means that you're seeing movements in how much crime is being recorded, not because more crime is taking place, but because the police have got their act together and recording it. That's why we've made such a fuss of this.
And you're seeing a significant increase in crime, in recorded violent crime specifically in the UK. And the challenge over the last few years has been trying to distinguish how much of that is improvement in recording practices, and how much of it is genuine. And this is exactly the hard part of dealing with uncertainty. It's a really difficult question. You've got questions about the quality of the data, potential alternative explanations, and I think the feeling I would get from some of the home affairs experts in the building is maybe we're a little bit slow. Because you've got a leading indicator in homicide that was going up since 2014, and that's always measured pretty well. And that's been going up for a long time. And it took a while, I think, and I would say this is, while I've said some complimentary things about the ONS, I think I would have got a sense, even in 2017, there's a lot of, let's wait until the standard errors change. Let's wait until it's bigger than the standard errors and it's largely recording. Whereas there were leading indicators in homicide that were telling us there was something going on. And that's the hard part for any statistician, where you've got something that's a surrogate measure that's, you know, and there's other things that are going in different directions. How do you integrate evidence? That's the real challenge.
It seems to me that what you're saying about migration and crime, that the future is going to be on triangulating from multiple sources in order to come up with some composite figure. Let's move on. Final topic. opinion polls. I mean, who worries about those? Well, people have been worrying about those because in the UK, we've just had a general election. So, Robert, that must have been quite a pressured time for you. You know, what's work like during a general election as a statistician?
Well, my other half is a political reporter for The Times. So we kind of haven't seen each other, and our offspring haven't really seen us either. But, you know, apart from that, it's been great.
Apart from that, it's been great. So, I mean, can we trust the polls?
Yes, but it depends on what question you're asking them. So if you're asking them, if you're going to bet your house on exactly who's going to get the most seats in the House of Commons on the basis of an opinion poll on vote share, well, I will happily take that bet from you. I will give you great odds and I will take all your money because they are not suitable for that question. But they are suitable for telling us broad trends about what's going on in public opinion, what people are thinking of the parties and what's changing. So we could learn a lot from the polls as long as you ask the right question that they can help with.
How reliable do you think an individual poll is?
Well, simple stats would tell you, you know, with all the formulas, you get about plus or minus 3 points. But actually, the British Polling Council did an analysis in 2017, and they looked at the track record of opinion polls since 2000. And since then, they've asked all of their members to put a statement out with every opinion poll that says there's a 90% chance that this poll or that 90% chance will be within about plus or minus 4 points. So the simple statistical error that we talk about is only part of the picture. And a lot of it comes from those questions are we polling the right people? Or are we dealing in the right way with people who say they might vote, they might not vote? Or what about the people who say they don't know? Are we breaking them appropriately? So you've got all of these other questions that feed into the uncertainty. And that adds a lot.
I mean, I use just a rough rule of thumb that whatever the sort of mathematics says, I double it in terms of how wide my uncertainty is.
Yeah, and it's not too far off where that statement is taking you. But the trouble is, plus or minus 4 points is the difference between kind of the Conservative lead that we saw, you know, a day or two before the election was about 10 points in the poll. Now, the sophologists, the experts will tell you 6 points and you're kind of in hung parliament territory and 14 points you're in a landslide. So the margins for error in the polls are the difference between a hung parliament and a total landslide. So they're really not very useful for giving you that fine-grained betting information that some people want.
So, Sarah, you looked at different ways in which you could visualize polling data, you know, the whole because these polls are coming out all the time. And again, yeah, I've said, you know, the first rule of communication is just shut up and listen. So you did some research into what the punters out there actually might make of the different ways to visualize polling data. What did you find?
Absolutely. So actually, it was in collaboration with Robert and some of his team. They produced some very beautiful graphics for me to test. So again, similar to the migration data with the polling data, you have these trends over time in party support, which for the major parties in the UK. And you see that trend line, which is the average trend line. And what we were interested in testing was whether if you actually show people the polling data that constitutes that trend line, again, does that affect how much they trust the information or how much they like it or how much they understand it. So the representation, one of the representations of those polling figures around the central trend line, if you imagine you have the central, the average trend in party support for lots of different parties, all in their respective colours. And then around that, you have dots showing above and below all the different individual polls from which the average trend is taken. So it looks a little bit like a scatter graph with different trend lines on it. And that was one of the formats that we wanted to test for Robert and his team to see, as I said, whether people understood this information compared to when you just showed people the.
Because it is quite complicated, and as Robert said, if you know, you don't want to overload people with information.
Absolutely, and I think when you know, if you also these charts are not just plotting out the support for the Conservative Party or for the Labour Party. You might have 8 different parties on there at the same time. So it's finding that balance between overloading people's sort of cognitive load, if you like, and giving them enough information so that they can be informed about those things. One of the advantages of showing them the polling figures is to say that actually, well, maybe we're not as certain about this particular number, this particular level of party support, maybe we're not that certain about that, and we can see that the figure might be somewhat higher or somewhat lower, or much higher or much lower, and presenting people with the individual polling numbers might give them a better handle on that.
So what do people feel about this?
So again, similar to the migration data, when we ask them how easy do you think this graph is to understand, or how much do you like it, how informative do you think it is, when we showed them the uncertain data, they rated it as being less easy to understand than when we didn't show them those polling figures, so when we just showed them the lines. But actually, again, when we got them to use the information to answer questions about, you know, which party was in the lead in terms of public support at a particular point in time, they were able to use that information just as well in those graphs where we showed them the individual polling figures versus when we didn't. And again, we asked them questions about perceptions of the trustworthiness of that data, and they rated it as being just as trustworthy when they saw those uncertain data points around it than when we just showed them the trend.
So Robert, so how did you go about making choices for the BBC poll tracker?
One part was the work we do with Sarah to understand that kind of main classical presentation of a poll tracker, where you see the lines for the parties developing as their support changes over time. But one thing that we were particularly proud of doing as well, in addition to that, was to add in a different way of presenting the information that just focuses on the most recent data. And if you can imagine, for each party, we've got 100 dots in total, and if one party's on 35%, we give them 35 dots. But what we did in addition to that was to have their number of dots drifting upwards and downwards, like if you remember Knight Rider, that like Kit's cars, the little red light going up and down, to show that the number is probably here, but it could be a bit higher or a bit lower. And so that focuses on that simple question that most people are interested in, is how is this party doing at the moment, and communicates that key element of uncertainty as well. So that was a new thing that we brought to the poll tracker this year that we were pretty happy with.
Do you know how that went down?
Well, we haven't got all of the audience figures back in yet, and all of the feedback that we will do. Normally, there's a wash up after an election campaign where we review all the work, and so we'll find out then. But it is, as Sarah said, you want to evaluate how these things go down. You want to find out how something lands.
Well, I liked it. I mean, I like the idea that putting the dots in, just the variability implicitly communicates the uncertainty about the line that's been fitted through them. And then also adding in what you calculate to be the general actual uncertainty around the poll figures seems to be a big improvement.
Well, I'll take that piece of audience feedback very happily.
Audience of one.
That's significant. Plenty for me.
Ed, are you allowed to say, what do you think about the elections?
Well, we were quite busy and active. You know, we're here to ensure that statistics serve the public good, and we think that's never more important than during a time when citizens make their biggest choice, which is who they vote for. So we were very active. We made a number of statements where we saw uses of statistic that we thought we could help clarify. I think the point is that we're not really a referee of who's got the best arguments or who's right. We're not an all-purpose fact checker. What we do is we want to stand up for making sure the statistics, which are having this social life, having their moment on the stage, are being properly understood. So we said things about homelessness. We said things about school funding. We said things about crime, indeed, the very issue we were talking about earlier. And I think one really, really important point which came from that is that it's quite often it's not just that, you know, politicians find themselves saying things that, you know, they ought not to, or that they regret. Sometimes it's that the underlying statistics are not giving them a clear picture. That's the story with crime, with homelessness. You know, how do you get a good measure of homelessness when you're measuring people who are in statutory homelessness and people who are rough sleeping and people who are in temporary accommodation? You know, the statistics that are published are not giving that triangulated, integrated picture. Similarly, the funding of schools, you're not getting official statistics which are giving a clear picture. So with the statistics not doing that, it's kind of harder for the politicians to kind of know where to turn to get a clear answer. So that's very much our job, is to drive the production of statistics to give this much richer, more integrated picture to help people understand the roundedness of a problem.
So at election time, the statistics aren't just having a social life, they're positively partying.
That's exactly right.
Okay, we're coming to the end now. Key things I've got out of this fascinating conversation is the importance of listening to the audience, is seeing what they understand, that actually communicating uncertainty does not necessarily reduce trust in the sources of the data, but people find it more difficult to understand, and so we've got to be careful not to overload people. But actually, being clear about the uncertainty and the quality of the underlying stats is absolutely vital for their use in society. Ed, do you have any extra things you'd like to say?
I think what's really struck me as we've gone around this set of issues together is this point about integrating a range of different sources is so much more effective than just relying on one single collection with all of its flaws. I think that's come through, and we talked about migration, about crime, and to some extent also about polls. And I think that's an incredibly powerful message that I've
taken
from
our
discussion.
And that's going to be the big development in stats in the future, I think. Sarah?
The final thing that I'd like to say is just to highlight really the importance of evaluating whatever message we put out there, especially if the landscape of how these national statistics are being constructed is changing. I think we need to make sure that we do actually go and not just speak to people, but also test experimentally how people respond to these new formats and these new communications.
So, Robert. Yeah, we've been discussing all these uncertainties around these numbers. How do you put those into a story?
Well, like you said, any number is soft, or any series of numbers that you're trying to tie together, they've all got weaknesses. The main question is, how do the weaknesses impact the story? What's the question you're asking? And are those weaknesses relevant to what you're trying to say? And if they are, well, then how do you communicate them to the audience? How do you tell them in a way that they'll like and that they'll understand? And so those are the questions. You know, what do your audience need to know? What's the question? And how important is the uncertainty to that question?
That's brilliant. That brings us to the end. It's time to say a huge thank you to my guests, Robert Cuff, Sarah Dryhurst, and Ed Humphson. And it's goodbye from me and the Risky Talk team.
Risky Talk is produced by Ilan Goodman at the Winton Centre for Risk and Evidence Communication in the University of Cambridge.